Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Jack Brighton and Harriet Williamson, and Jason Croft is on the board this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about capital punishment in America, what attitudes are, and in fact, how attitudes may be changing. Our guest for the program is Robert J. Lifton. He is a psychiatrist. He's director of the Center on Violence and Human Survival at John Jay College. He also teaches at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He is author of a number of books. We'll be talking this morning about his most recent, which he co-authored with Greg Mitchell. The title of the book is Who Owns Death? The subtitle, Capital Punishment, The American Conscience, and the End of Executions. It's published by William Morrow and Company. And in the book, they argue, the authors, among other things, that sometime in the near future, they expect to see capital punishment abolished in this country. We'll talk about that and other things, and of course, encourage calls from people who are listening. If you have questions, comments, they're welcome. All we ask of callers, just one thing, try to be brief in your comments. And we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along, accommodate as many different people as possible. But you're welcome to call if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So you can use that number, whichever works best for you. And if you match the numbers with the letters on the phone, you get WILL. So that's another way to do it, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Lifton, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us.
I'm happy to be with you.
Just right up front, maybe I will ask about the two conclusions that you, in your preface, say you reached, two things that surprised you. And here's the first one. You write that you find the prevailing wisdom that America is fiercely in favor of executions is largely wrong.
That's right. It's wrong because it doesn't take into account the shifts in American consciousness, which the polls have really indicated, and also the contradiction between Americans still seemingly having the need to have the death penalty on the books, but having considerable reluctance to carrying it out. When you consider the hundreds, even thousands of people on death row, and still, despite the increase in executions, the relatively few executions, you can begin to understand this disparity. And the further finding, which is very significant, especially in the last year or two, is that not only is support for the death penalty diminishing in sequence of polls being taken, but when you juxtapose it with life imprisonment without possibility of parole, it no longer is support for the death penalty. It's something like 50% and sometimes dipping below 50%. It's only in the last year or two that Americans have developed confidence in the possibility of a sentence of life imprisonment without parole, as that sentence meaning what it says. And with that confidence in that alternative sentence, there has been this radical drop in support for the death penalty.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the problem with surveys is it all depends on how you ask the question. What you're suggesting is that if you ask people their feelings about the death penalty and then you say to them, if we could guarantee that this individual who was found guilty of murder would be put in prison and would never, ever absolutely get out, would you then be willing to say, all right, it's okay, life sentence instead of death penalty? We've seen an increase in the number of people who, given that assurance, would say, all right, well, in that case, I would say put the person in prison for the rest of their life, not execute.
And of course, life imprisonment without possibility of parole is itself a draconian punishment. It's no minor matter. But what the sequence of polls in this direction does show is that Americans aren't fixated on the idea of legal killing, of state murder, in response to murder on the part of individuals. Part of the support of the death penalty has been in response to the fear that these murderers will murder again. And it's that fear that's taken into account in the alternative sentence of life imprisonment without parole. And of course, it is true that society has to protect itself from those who might kill again, even though this kind of recidivism is relatively rare, except in serial killers. But it is a real concern that has to be accounted for in society.
It seems that a good deal of the erosion for support of the death penalty is due to the increasing numbers of individuals who had been convicted, were awaiting the sentence, and then were exonerated. And it seems to be that people are starting to be concerned about people incorrectly convicted, and that motivates their concern more than the idea that, in the abstract, there's something wrong with execution on moral or some other basis. Do you think that that's the case?
I think that may be true. Well, I would put it this way. I think that Americans, even in supporting the death penalty, have some inner doubt, and it has takes the form often of a sense that to kill people, to have the state kill people, is a form of hubris. To take lives is something that only God has the ability or the right to do. So that even with support for the death penalty, there is that inner doubt that there may be something wrong with killing people. Having said that, there is now a rush of evidence of wrongful convictions of people on death row who can be established to be innocent with the very important help of the new technology of DNA tests. The improved technology of DNA tests is very crucial here because it gives us a scientific means of clearly establishing innocence. And that's why the so-called Innocence Project of Barashek and others takes on such great importance. And also, Governor Ryan's moratorium in Illinois, which, as you know, took shape after he had incontrovertible evidence given him by law professors and law students that a sizable number of people on death row were indeed innocent. And I think that the idea of putting to death innocent people is really something that's intolerable to the American people. There still remains in the American people a strong sense of fair play, and what more ultimate violation of fair play could take place than the killing of innocent people? Mm-hmm. And this, in turn, I think, really reveals the difficulty and the unease of carrying a death penalty in a democracy.
Yeah, I think here in the state of Illinois, the figures are rather sobering. It is the case, I hope I'm remembering this correctly because it's been a while since I looked at this, but I believe that it's the case that since the death penalty was reinstated here in the state of Illinois, 12 people have been executed, 13 people have been exonerated, and it was when the balance tipped, at one point it was 12 and 12, and it was when it went to 13 and 12, that's when Mr. Ryan imposed the moratorium. I'm not certain why it was so much more different when it was 13 and 12 than 12 and 12, but that's...
I'm not sure that it was, you know, fundamentally different, 12 and 12 or 13 and 12, but it was as if something was taking shape in Governor Ryan's mind, and it had to do with a conscience, a kind of governing, the conscience of a governor, of a political leader, which called upon him to avoid an act which might end in the death of an innocent person or a number of innocent people. And it's Governor Ryan's act and his own journey have been enormously important in this whole issue because, as you know, the moratorium model that he established has been taken on by a number of other states and cities and areas. And it was purely an act of conscience because Governor Ryan, as you know, had always been in favor of the death penalty and had been a conservative Republican governor. So it's a very important act in this whole sequence and in this shift in the shift in consciousness of the American people that's taking place.
Let me. There are a number of things that we can talk about, though, and I have some callers, so we'll get right to them. But let me just for a moment also then go to the other of these two conclusions that you talk about in the preface that you say surprised you. The first, we talked about the fact that our perception that America is fiercely in favor of execution is incorrect. The other, you write this, our second conclusion also challenges conventional thinking. We believe that even as the execution rate soars, the death penalty's days are numbered.
Yes, well, when we began to say this a couple of years ago, people thought, well, you know, they're being wishful. It's a nice idea, but can you really believe it? It's interesting that now people are more and more tending to agree with us. Everyone senses that there has been a major shift in consciousness. Just one indicator, it seems small or maybe not so small, but during the second debate, the notorious exchange, the presidential debate during the campaign, the notorious exchange that took place on the death penalty, most people will remember, those who witnessed the debate, and it was when Governor Bush, President-elect Bush, at that time responded to a question about good and evil by saying, well, we are putting to death three people. That's the act of true justice. In fact, he had exaggerated. It was only two people who were being put to death, but the whole spirit was an enthusiastic endorsement of the death penalty. The reaction of the American people at that time was, in a way, surprising. They tended to be appalled by this enthusiasm, and Bush had to backtrack in subsequent statements. And even Bush himself, and we quote him in our book, has said on a number of occasions that decisions he made against commuting sentences were among the most painful decisions he ever made as governor. And he also indicated that he had to, in some way, call upon a higher power, in a sense, ask the will of God, again, perhaps expressing in his mind and in the mind of so many others the idea that this decision is not one that should or can justifiably be made by ordinary human beings. There are other indications of the shift in consciousness, and one of them that we emphasize in our book is the increasing evidence of pain, unease, and even post-traumatic symptoms on the part of those assigned to carrying out the executions. And we find enormous ambivalence on everyone concerned with the death penalty, or in everyone concerned with the death penalty, from governors to prosecutors to juries to judges to wardens to teams who are in charge of the actual execution process. Everyone, every group of those people, no matter what steps are taken to diminish their pain or their ambivalence, they all express misgivings, doubts, ambivalences.
We're talking this morning with Robert J. Lifton. He is director of the Center on Violence and Human Survival at John Jay College. He also teaches at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and has done research and written on a wide range of topics. He's done psychological research on the problem of apocalyptic violence. He has written on Nazi doctors and the problem of genocide. He's written about nuclear weapons, about the Chinese Cultural Revolution, about survivors of Hiroshima. He's written a number of books. His most recent, which he co-authored with Greg Mitchell, deals with this topic we're discussing today. The title is Who Owns Death? Capital Punishment, The American Conscience, and the End of Executions, and is published by William Morrow and Company. We have a caller. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Champaign County on line one. Hello?
Excuse me. I am at lunch right now, so I'll try to get this out, as it were. I had occasion to hear Governor Ryer's address to the New York Law Board, or
Bar Association, maybe.
Bar Association, yeah. It was a couple of weeks ago, and it was just replayed on alternative media here. And I was happily surprised, contrary to the gray-coat Republicans who were having misgivings about Ryan for a number of other reasons, including the death penalty moratorium, which around here there's a judge that gets on the radio and the local chat shows and said that he technically had no right to do that kind of thing. But anyway... His questioning of the death penalty actually went further than the death penalty, and he has apparently authentic misgivings about the entire legal system is the way it's racially in class. I don't think he actually used those words, but it isn't just he's not just questioning the death penalty itself. He's actually questioning the judicial system and how justice is meted out to people at different levels of the society, which is rather astonishing. And
I didn't hear that address, but from what I understand, Governor Ryan has been on a kind of political and spiritual journey of his own. He really performed a very courageous act in initiating that moratorium, in my view. And since that time, he's read up on the whole issue, talked to people, and probed more deeply into the whole problem. I don't know whether he raised this issue, but one issue for many of us has to do with the relationship of the American legal system specifically to the death penalty. And that, of course, has to do with both the death penalty and the way the legal system functions. We have, as everybody knows, an adversary system. It's a very intensely adversary system, and perhaps it's one of the better systems because each side has its day in court and has its own arguments from its own side. But anybody who watches these things has to have a profound sense of unease and absurdity at the idea that this adversary system can result in the death of a human being, because the adversary system is really a contest, a game, and it depends upon the skills and maneuverability and cleverness of those participating in it. And as is also now widely known, and as Governor Ryan and others learned, often people accused of people receiving the death penalty get very, very poor legal defense, so that the people playing the game are very bad at it or not even interested in it. But the idea that the skill or qualities of particular lawyers in playing this legal game, in engaging in this content, can result in a death is what we have to look at here. And that's the heart of the problem in the relation between the American legal system and the death penalty. Other lawyers who've worked in it have said, and I think convincingly, that the death penalty tends to corrupt the whole legal system. It drains its resources, and it leads to the kinds of corruptions in the lack of authentic legal defense that I just mentioned. And it prevents society in many ways, or at least impairs the capacity of society to take the kind of steps that might diminish the sort of violence and homicide that resulted in the problem in the first place.
He named that specifically, and he went on to even talk about police abuse and just DA abuse, in the sense of he was very harsh in condemning people sentenced to death from jailhouse informants, or someone who gets out of jail free, gets for testifying against somebody, says that this guy confessed to the crime in jail when I was with him. And I was absolutely surprised. I don't know that it's going to do his political career any good, but I trust that he might sleep a little more comfortably.
Yes.
Thank you very much. I got to go.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go on to another caller here. This is Urbana. That's line number two. Hello.
Good morning. I have to agree with the last caller. Governor Ryan's address to the New York Bar Association was stunning, really. The man is, I believe, is trying to be an old Lincoln Republican in his own way. And I wonder why it is that we have to listen to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! From Pacifica Radio in order to find out what the governor of Illinois is saying, and why that address couldn't possibly be broadcast over WILL. The question is really for you, David. Thanks to the last caller. Bye.
Okay. I have to be perfectly honest with you and say that this is the first that I've heard about it. We can broadcast things when they're made available to us. There are questions of rights and so forth. Perhaps we can look into it and find out more about it.
Let me say another thing about Governor Ryan and his conscience. The two callers have both been struck by what he said in this mm-hmm. address, and we have to here note the kind of spiritual journey that Governor Ryan has embarked on, and that tells us that people can change, that one isn't in a fixed position forever. if one opens one's conscience to it, and there's no issue in American life that calls upon the American conscience really more than the death penalty.
As far as we know, I think it's we believe that throughout human history, capital punishment has existed. That's not to say that there weren't times when people said that they weren't going to do that. But given the fact that it seems like it's been around for a long, long time, and that seems to be motivated by a very elemental feeling of justice that still exists today, I'm interested in how it is you're thinking about how that thinking comes about, and how it is that for those people who would say that if a person commits murder, if they kill another person, they should die. Simple.
Right.
It's a simple matter of moral equivalency. How it is that if that is an individual's reason for supporting capital punishment, how you make some sort of counter argument to that?
Capital punishment has been around from almost the beginning of history. It's true. One has to counter that statement, though, by saying that capital punishment has been abolished throughout all Western contemporary democracies, so that sometime during the latter part of the 20th century, there was something in the way of an advance in history, and we have to be grateful for any such advances, which raised questions about a very ancient custom. And what you're raising in talking about it is, and these issues can never be totally clarified, the relationship between, let's say, justice, retribution, and revenge. Certainly, when there's murder, when there's killing on the part of anyone, there's a universal call for justice. The person guilty, if that guilt can be clearly established, has to be called before the dock, before some kind of tribunal. Retribution suggests that a society must have some means of punishment that's appropriate to the act. Revenge suggests that one uses fierce physical measures, and very likely murderous ones, against the person who's accused or established himself as a murderer. The idea of revenge has never left us, and certainly it's a very human feeling that anybody would be likely to have if he or she had somebody murdered in one's own family. And we say in our book, Greg Mitchell and I, if that happened to one of us, we would be the first and have the strongest kind of vengeful emotions. But then we ask ourselves, would we be able to step back and raise the question of whether the state should kill? Again, to get at the problem in perhaps circuitous ways, but that are meaningful, I did a study of Nazi doctors earlier on, and I was much concerned with the nefarious career of Josef Mengele. And I talked to many survivors who had been under the power of Mengele and who had witnessed his evil actions. And I talked to them about their feelings about Mengele when much was in the press about whether he was captured, whether that was his body that was found, and so on. And their tendencies were mostly, let's bring him to justice. Let him come before a judge, a jury, a doc, and be accused of what he did and recognize what he did to us. That was their primary emotion. Over years, feelings of revenge had diminished. They hadn't been absent, but it was more justice and some measure of retribution. In a way, we can say that, or at least I would think that, society is capable of recognizing vengeful feelings, impulses toward revenge, when terrible crimes of this kind are committed, but at the same time refusing to act on those vengeful emotions and taking hold of a system of justice that stops short of killing. We see that the absence of the death penalty is a functional arrangement now throughout Western Europe and through a good part of the world, and we have no reason to believe that it can't continue to be so.
Let me ask another question that you indeed pose in, at one point in the book where you look at the history of executions in America, and that is, why is it that capital punishment has proved so enduring in this country?
Yes, that's a it's a nagging question, and it has to be addressed. You know, there are many theories about it, and nobody can be certain. And we raise really two interwoven historical currents in the United States that we think are very important. One is what I've called in other work the American habit of violence, and it has to do with the frontier and with the worship of the gun, even though that worship has been supplemented by economic and by the gun lobby and its enormous economic benefits. But nonetheless, the worship of the gun and the relationship of the gun to our creation mythology in the American Revolution and the glorification of the militias, often in ways that aren't entirely accurate historically, which has continued into various particular guns and then later guns and gunism, as I call it, another work, or a terrible word, or a gunocracy in which the gun has taken a sacred place. And we do lead the world in guns and their numbers and their dangers. That has been interwoven with an American evangelical impulse from very early on toward absolute distinction between good and evil and retribution toward evil and separation from the good in very absolute polarized ways. And that habit of violence tied in with a kind of polarized sense of good and evil certainly can contribute, I believe, historically to the American continuous embrace of the death penalty. But in saying that, it doesn't mean that this has to be the situation forever or that historical tendencies can change. Just as Governor Ryan has changed significantly in an individual psychological and political way, so can the American state, and so is it now changing in relation to larger historical currents.
We are a little bit past the midpoint of this hour of Focus 580. We have other callers we'll get to in just a second. I just want to take a moment to introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Robert J. Lifton. He's director of the Center on Violence and Human Survival at John Jay College and also teaches at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He is the co-author of the recent book that explores this issue. If you're interested in reading on it, you could look for the book. It's titled Who Owns Death? And it's published by William Morrow and Company. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. That's for folks who are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, and toll-free anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call for you, the toll-free line is 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here in Champaign. We'll take them in the order they came in, starting with line one. Hello.
Hi. Well, a couple of things. First of all, while I support Ryan's change of heart, I wonder how much that's influenced by that epiphany is influenced by his own legal problems that he's facing as a corruption scandal gets closer to him. But also, I mean, in point, I didn't catch the very first part. You may have pointed this out. You know, the absurdity of these appeal system and the adversarial system, I think, was really pointed out by a case that, as I recall, at least in the initial appeal of a death penalty where the lawyer was falling asleep during the trial, and the court ruled that this, you know, in and of itself wasn't sufficient evidence that, you know, he didn't get an adequate defense, and that they had to show something more than the mere fact that the lawyer was, you know, falling asleep during the trial. And as far as psychology, I also am curious what you think about what I find a schism between people who are opposed to abortion but support strongly the death penalty.
Well, to take your second point first, the whole relation of the Catholic hierarchy and the Catholic bishops particularly to the death penalty is interesting in that regard. Some years ago, the bishop's pastoral letter on nuclear weapons, which was a major document in the anti-nuclear movement, was predicated on bishops being prodded by their younger priests to be consistent in their conscience, so that if they opposed abortion, they must oppose the mass death that could be potentially caused by nuclear weapons. And the bishops were honorable enough to declare that consistency. And one can say there's a similar process taking place. I don't applaud their anti-abortion stand, although I'm no lover of abortion. But to be consistent, many oppose the death penalty, and the Pope has now taken a stronger stand against the death penalty than he has in the past, so that I think among many, but not all of the Catholic hierarchy, the idea of opposing the death penalty is consistent with a right-to-life stance. That has to be honored.
Of course, they don't have as much influence in the media as Jerry Falwell and Rush Limbaugh and folks like that.
Well, it is true that a lot of the Christian fundamentalist movements strongly support the death penalty, though occasionally they've wavered also in cases where prisoners have had some kind of conversion reaction in prison, and they have then questioned the death penalty. I don't think that the support for the death penalty is absolutely fixed in any area of our society, although the Republican right and the fundamentalist Christian groups are perhaps its strongest area of support.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. We'll go to another Champaign person. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. Yes. Fascinating topic. A couple of things that I would like to ask the author is let's look at something that many of the Americans in this capitalist society definitely rule their lives on, and that's, what is the bottom line? How much does prosecutors seeking the death penalty end up costing their county? Because most of these capital trials end up costing the counties all around the death belt in the southern part of the United States, and even to this extent, you know, in the Midwest. The seeking of the death penalty in capital cases, the cost far exceeds that of confronting a suspect with the knowledge that we will seek the life without the possibility of parole, and we know that maybe the evidence is overwhelming, and the cost for life without the possibility of parole, when amortized, both in the trial phase of seeking, you know, of a guilty plea, and then the caretaking of the prisoner, is extremely less expensive over the long term.
Well, there's a kind of painful dynamic here. As you rightly say, there's nothing more expensive than seeking the death penalty, and it's been established again and again that it costs much more to put a person to death than it does to keep a person in prison for life.
Mm-hmm.
And that cost, as you say, the bottom line elements have to do with the cost of the prosecution, the cost of the execution, and of all the appeals. Now, one way of cutting down on these bottom line costs is to try to diminish the possibility of appeals.
That's correct.
Cut down legally on the right to appeals. However, when you do that, at least doing it completely, is hard to carry through in a democracy.
Right.
Once you start cutting down on appeals, you're really questioning, I think, the democratic process, particularly when it can end up putting a man to death. And in that way, there's a continuous struggle around these issues, which is another way of saying that the death penalty rests very uneasily in a nation that calls itself a democracy.
One of the last things, or two things, I would like to hear from more listeners that are possibly more conservative in nature on their considerations in the time remaining. And the last, I would like to know if you have any information, because capital crime and the seeking of the death penalty in a trial phase seems to be a large propellant for many prosecutors into higher political office across the United States, here in Illinois and everywhere else. How many of the House of Representatives and the United States Senators got where they got because they were tough on murder? I'm going to hang up and let you see if you've got any numbers. I'd like to hear how many folks got where they are by doing that.
Well, I have no idea about the numbers. I can't answer that. But what I can say is that the real point of what you're saying is that there is an enormous political edge, or political center, one might say, to decisions to make cases capital cases. There's a political judgment. What will this do for me, for my party, in this state, in this county? And when you stop to think of it, that's a very, to say the least, unacceptable motivation for a capital case. Having said that, one begins to have the right to wonder whether the political capital is diminishing or whether the political weather vane may be shifting. In that regard, one indication is that President Clinton, he's still president for now, himself praised Governor Ryan for his moratorium, even though Clinton has been a notorious advocate of the death penalty. And in other federal cases now, his support for the death penalty has at least subsided or weakened, so that it may be that there is a change here which can politically affect those who are using the death penalty for personal and political purposes. And it may be that in the future it might not be so beneficial to one's career to press for death penalty cases. I think we're seeing that switch. It's not going to occur at any one sudden moment of Saturi, but it can be a gradual, incremental process that we're in the middle of right now.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest, Robert J. Lifton. He's director of the Center on Violence and Human Survival at John Jay College. He also teaches at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And if you would like to read more on the subject, you can look for a book that he co-authored. The title of the book is Who Owns Death? Capital Punishment, The American Conscience, and the End of Executions, published by William Morrow. We have several callers here. One quick question I'd like to ask, and then we'll go get back to the phones here. I think that some of the people who continue to support the death penalty do so because they believe that it has a deterrent effect. It's something I know that various criminologists and psychologists have looked at. Do you think that there is evidence to show one way or the other that either it is or is not?
There is lots of evidence that shows that the death penalty has no deterrent value whatsoever. Every single study has had this conclusion. There is a suspicion, though not established, that the death penalty may be an impetus, a stimulus to further violence. But it certainly has been established that there has never been any evidence that it has any deterrent effect. Then one must ask, why do people still insist that it does have that deterrent effect? And again, to go back to that notorious exchange during the second presidential debate, both candidates, first Governor Bush said, yes, he's in favor of the death penalty because it deters murder, and then Al Gore said, yes, he's in favor of it insofar as it deters. He was a little weaker, but he still connected it with deterrence. They were both wrong, because all the evidence shows that there is no deterrence that results from it. I think that there's a psychological need to believe that if we kill murderers and the word gets around, people will stop murdering. That seems logical, but it doesn't take human psychology, individual psychology, into effect, because it can be often the opposite effect. Very often, murderers are as well suicidal. There have been psychiatric studies establishing the relationship between murder and suicide. And in effect, the death penalty could be an attraction to killing, because then the state will carry out one's suicidal inclinations for one. So I think one has to look very critically about the idea of deterrence and uncover it as an illusion.
We have other callers. Let's go to Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question for the caller. When he was, before he was talking about this sort of mythology of the gun, and I was sort of, it kind of dawned on me that in this country, the level of violence is really high for a country where there's no war, you know, inside the country. And I'm really curious as to what the speaker thinks. The reason for that is, like, why do we allow so much violence in our country? You know, I mean, there's so much violence just done on everyday citizens that no one really, really looks at.
Yes, and I agree. And we are a violent society, and I spoke earlier briefly about the habit of violence that goes deep into our history. Of course, we're not the only country with violence, but we seem to have more of it and more gun-centered violence than anybody else. And I think that part of the motivation for supporting the death penalty is to, quotes, get rid of violence and to get rid of crime, get rid of murder. It's as if one is doing something about this nagging and frightening problem of violence. Of course, one is doing the wrong thing, and one is committing more violence in the name of combating violence, but it can give people a sense that at least some measure is being taken. And the other thing I would say in relation to the point you make is that, yes, we haven't been at, well, I can't say we haven't been at war for some time. The Gulf War is not that old, and even the Vietnam War is not that extremely old. But one prosecutor we quote in our book as saying that he's an ardent advocate of the death penalty and seeks capital cases because he sees himself on a mission. He said, our generation hasn't had a war to fight, and I take this to be our war, our mission. So in that sense, it can be a substitute for war, an expression of the, quotes, war on crime, which sadly may be motivated partly by the impulse to get rid of violence, but it is a way of pouring more violence into the society.
Okay, I hope the caller will forgive me for wanting to go on here. The lines are full and time is short. Let's go to Champaign next. That's line number 3. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
Yes.
I am for capital punishment because of the way I understand the Bible. Now, there is a big distinction about if it's murder, there are to be punished by capital punishment. If it's manslaughter or something like that, it isn't. And lots of times the people that are convicted as murderers are because the prosecutor is trying to make a name for himself, and so he doesn't use all the evidence that he has. And I think that's the reason a lot of people get blamed for murdering somebody when really they are innocent.
Well, you know, I respect your view, and I'm no great authority on biblical terminology or rhetoric, but I think one can say that the Bible says many things in it, and Christianity has taken opposite directions in relation to the death penalty and other issues. One can embrace the idea of a vengeful God, a vengeful Old Testament God, and see in the continuity of that justification for the death penalty, or one can take the wisdom and the compassion of the Sermon on the Mount as an expression of compassion and against state killing and against the death penalty. And certainly many people who work in opposition to the death penalty, Sister Prejean is a very notable example, do so from their Christian roots, and it's out of their Christian compassion that they oppose the death penalty.
Let's go to another caller. This is Savoy. It's line 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Dr. Lipton, have you
yes.
presented at the Psychiatric Association meetings?
Did you, Dr. Lipton, did you hear the question?
No, I didn't.
Maybe a caller, you help us if you'd speak up a little bit.
Has the doctor spoken at the Psychiatric Association meetings?
Well, I've spoken many times at the American Psychiatric Association, but not yet on the death penalty.
No. Okay.
I'm sure I will, speak before psychiatric groups in one place or another in relation to the death penalty.
But I thought you were Jewish, and I was wondering if, therefore, you could tell us what the various thinking of the theologians in American Jewry is about the death penalty.
I am Jewish, but I think that Jewish thought is divided like as is other thought on the death penalty, and there can be ambivalence and there can be compassion in opposing the death penalty coming from Jewish sources as comes from Christian sources and even Islamic sources.
Let's go on to Crete here, line number 4 for our last person. Hello.
Yes, I would like to say that there's also the racial component that you didn't mention regarding the death penalty along with the historical and the religious, and also the fact that we've just elected the man who has been responsible for more executions than any governor in the history of this country does not bode well for your futuristic propositions. And secondly, each year the number of people executed goes up. So I would like to have a response from the racial aspect, the governor being new president, and the fact that each year we have more executions.
Well, I could only hear most clearly the part about the racial aspect, which is very important because it's been shown again and again, if you're a minority person, if you're black and Hispanic and you kill a white person, you're much more likely to get the death penalty than if you're a white person and you kill a black or Hispanic. That in itself is direct evidence of the uneven, inequitable application of the death penalty. But it's worse than that. It's not only race and ethnic group. It's also which county you happen to be in, whether they have a very zealous prosecuting attorney who has ambitions that are connected with the death penalty, and what the political structure is in that particular county or state. And it's this uneven and irrational application that turns many Americans, that violates their spirit of fairness and turns many of them against the death penalty. And to which I would further add, some people will say, therefore, well, why not fix it and make it equitable? Well, you can never fix it perfectly because there's always the flawed human approach. There's always human error. And to that extent, insofar as we cannot eliminate human error, I would say we have no right to have the state kill people.
I think the caller asked it, or made two other points, one that every year the number of executions increase, the other that now the president-elect comes from a state that is, I don't know if it's the number one state in executions, but it leads, it's a leading state in executions. He said those two things taken together might cause you not to be very optimistic about the death penalty going away anytime soon.
Yes. Well, you know, what we feel, and of course my co-author and I have talked a lot about this, and we've written a couple of op-ed columns about it, and we think that despite the incoming Bush administration and Bush's strong support in the past for the death penalty, we shouldn't assume that the opposition to the death penalty will be overcome or that it will cease to function or that it will not grow. Bush himself has made statements indicating a certain ambivalence about the death penalty, despite what he said publicly. And it looks as though there's a turnaround very slightly in what was formerly a steady increase each year in the number of executions. It looks like in the last few months or year, they may be slightly declining. It also looks as though there is a widening opposition to the death penalty, and with a focus on Texas as a state that kills more people than any other state in the Union. So all these aspects, along with the very, very important new technology of DNA, so that when we come upon the very first execution, followed upon by a DNA test that demonstrated that executed person to be an innocent man, when that happens, it hasn't happened yet, but it certainly will happen, there will be another turnabout and another jump in consciousness in opposing the death penalty. So in general, I would say that despite our very rational worries about the Bush administration in relation to the death penalty, one shouldn't assume that opposition won't continue to grow.
Well, there we will have to leave it because we are at the end of the time. We want to say to you, Dr. Lifton, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It's been an interesting dialogue for me.
Our guest, Robert J. Lifton, is director of the Center on Violence and Human Survival at John Jay College. He also teaches at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. His book, if you would like to read it, is titled Who Owns Death? It's published by William Morrow and Company. Our program, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from the massage therapy professionals at Bodywork Associates in Champaign. With helping hands and client education, the physical therapists at Bodywork help clients learn to reduce pain and improve their quality of life. Programming on WILL also made possible by a grant from the Silver Creek Restaurant, 402 North Ray Street in Urbana, offering fine dining for lunch and dinner in an historic Urbana setting that includes a greenhouse dining room. Silver Creek offers steaks, fresh seafood, vegetarian dishes, pastas, fine wines, and more. For more information, call 328-3402. That's it for us. We want you to stay tuned, though, for the Afternoon Magazine. The host today, Jay Pierce.
All right. Thanks a lot, David, and Happy New Year to you. Good to have you back after the holidays. And coming up in this first hour of Focus of the Afternoon Magazine, we are doing the transition here. We will have our regular assortment of news and information and, of course, talk to Mike. Mike Soto will be here to answer your weather questions. If you have some travel plans this weekend, you want to pay particular attention because, as you can see outside, we've had some snow.